Often in the course, we will make references to the mission organization that was started here at Eastern some 30 years ago, because a great deal of our programming and theoretical work revolves around the Evangelical Association for the Promotion of Education. We are very much an experimental group. We try out methodologies of working in the city and see how they work. And when they don't work, we're one of the few organizations that know how to dismantle them and say, it's not working, we're going to call it quits. The whole thing started when I first came to Eastern, which was a long, long time ago. And when I came to Eastern, no one in the country, I mean, there was not a single school in the country that had any kind of in-service learning experiences. Now, almost every school I know of has some kind of in-service learning program, you know, where you go in and tutor, or go in and work, and go in and do this, and go in and do that, and get their students involved in inner city work insofar as that is possible. So what happened was that I made arrangements with the college to use the school vans to cart students into Philadelphia and into Camden, New Jersey on Saturdays. Just Saturdays we were working at that time. And my goodness, it worked well. And we were working with hundreds of kids in these government housing projects doing a tutoring program on Saturday mornings. Every Saturday morning, get the vans and go down. One Saturday morning, we went down to get the vans, and the vans weren't available because the basketball team was playing a tournament, and they wanted the vans to go from the campus to the Philadelphia airport, which really bothered me because they had about five automobiles and could have easily used the automobiles to go down to the airport. And I begged them, I begged the team, do this. In those days, the basketball team really wasn't well integrated into the school. In those days, we were an NAIA basketball team, and we were really intent on winning and making a name for ourselves as a basketball power. We never did. But that was the great dream of the athletic director. And athletics were like the big thing on campus. And don't get me wrong, I am a semi-jock myself. When I went to Eastern here, I was captain of the university basketball team. So don't say I'm not concerned about sports. I played the game in high school. I played the game when I was in my college years. So I love the game. It's just that a Christian college ought to have its priorities straight. And it ought not to put basketball as the end all. And if it was just a matter of them not being able to get to the airport, that would have been fine. I would have understood. But they had a means. They just demanded the vans. So that particular day, there were about 250 kids that were downtown. And I had to drive in on my little car and say, hey, we're not doing it today. And I still remember their faces because they had become very attached to these volunteers who were going in on Saturdays. I came back to the school and I raised the roof with the dean and with the dean of students and said, where are our values? What's going on around here? And they made it clear. They did not see that this had anything to do with the academic work of the school. They did not see that this had anything to do with the intellectual achievements of students. They didn't see the connectedness between involvement in the city, working with people on the grassroots level, and what they were learning in classrooms. But then no school was doing that. It was the era of pure liberal arts. You know, you came to school to live in the ivory tower for 4 years, and then you would go out into the world. Well, you know, I didn't look at it that way, but they did. And they said, I said, is this going to happen again? They said, it could happen again. That's when I made the decision. I got together some of my friends, and what we did was we put together a board of directors, and we incorporated. Here's something you need to know. It's easy to incorporate. 501c3, you go down, you see a lawyer, and you say, I'm going to be starting a nonprofit organization. I want to apply for 501c3 status. It's very easy to get. What's more important is the day you apply for 501c status, because it can take up to a year for it to be approved by the federal government. The day you apply, from that day on, you're allowed to take donations and receipt the donations in such a way that the people will be able to get a tax deduction for their donation. So, you know, that's very important. People say, I'm going to give you $500, but I'd like to get a tax deduction for this. From the day you apply for a 501c3 status, from that day on, you can raise money, and the money that you get in as donations can all be treated as tax-free donations. It can be put on people's income tax legally as a deduction. At the end of the year, generally, it takes about a year for the 501c status to go through. At the end of the year, if you don't get it, then you can no longer raise money. But they are assuming that you're going to get it, because it's very, very seldom that the government ever turns down these kinds of requests. So that's something you need to know. If you're going to start a nonprofit, you get a lawyer and you apply for a 501c3 status and as a charitable organization. And what we started doing was raising money. And we began to find that it worked out well for us, primarily because I'm on the speaking circuit. And I get into a different church every week, and sometimes two or three different churches in a week. And generally, I use my connections with the churches to get money in, and that works out quite well. Now, you ought to know this about fundraising. We've tried all the techniques. This is only my own experience. The experts may, in fact, differ with me. But if you're going to raise money, realize this, that people don't like to give to an organization. They like to finance individuals. And so one of the things that I do, if you've ever heard me do this, some of you may have heard me in a church do this, generally I preach the sermon and don't mention anything about raising money in the sermon. I always ask for the privilege of saying the benediction. See? Can I say the benediction, Pastor? Oh, yes, sure. If you'd like to say the benediction, please. So, you know, you finish your talk, you sing the hymn, you get up, and they're still standing. And you say, folks, I need to ask you to do something for me. I have some young people who are involved in ministry. And whether or not they can continue in ministry has everything to do with whether or not I can raise support for them. Now, here's what I'm asking. I'm asking that you give me your name and address on any slip of paper you can find. And if you do, I'm hoping that that means that you'll commit to sending in a dollar a day. That's $30 a month. Most of you can afford that. That's less than you pay for a cup of coffee. A dollar a day. And you'll make it possible for one of our young people to be there on the field. You'll make it possible for a student to be in Cornerstone Christian Academy, which is one of our programs. You will make it possible for us to take in 3 children for our summer program. You know, this is what it'll do. $30 a month will do this, and you focus it on individuals. There are some children who aren't going to be served. There are some needy kids who aren't going to be reached. There are a lot of boys and girls that won't be loved into the kingdom if you say no. So please, I'm not asking. I'm begging. I'm begging on behalf of some wonderful young people who are risking their lives on the streets of the cities of this country every day. I'm asking on behalf of the boys and girls that they're trying to love into the kingdom day in and day out. So on the way out, give me your name and address on a slip of paper. And if you do that, I'll hug you. This goes over very well with elderly women. Being an elderly man, they haven't been hugged for a long time. Their husbands have been dead for 10 years. They would like a good hug. But because I do that to lighten it up a little bit, to laugh and, you know, say, you know. And it's amazing. If I have 1,000 people in the audience or in the congregation, I end up with maybe about 50 or 60 names on pieces of paper. I come back to my office and the guys in my office immediately send out letters to all of these people. And it works out very, very well. And we put them on the mailing list. And of the 60, I would say about 40 of them will follow through and will start sending monthly donations. Well, you can see what's going to happen. Over a period of time, you keep on adding 50, 60, 40, 30. You know, you can imagine what's going to happen. You're going to build up this mailing list. The result is we have one of the few Christian organizations that doesn't sweat about raising money. I mean, we just sit back and the money comes in. Nancy here is on our board of directors. That's not our concern. I mean, every other Christian organization you ever go into, the whole board meeting is, how are we going to raise money? Our issue is, how are we going to spend the money? Isn't that the way it goes? How are we going to spend them? That's our big issue. Because we always end up, this is strange, with more money than we need. We always run this huge surplus because the thing keeps on building and building and building. The net result is that we don't just simply let the money store up. We continually create new ministries. What we do is find young people like you, Hannah, who wants to do maybe social justice, or Rosella, you're interested in youth ministry. And we've spotted you. We've watched you in the academic setting. I've gotten to know you. And you say, you know, Tony, I'd like to start a program. I was studying a program in North Philadelphia, and I live in Southwest Philadelphia, and I would like to start a program like that there. And I'd say, come up with your business plan. Tell me how you're going to run this thing. Because by this time, if you don't know how to do that, you haven't been properly educated. That's what you're here to do, to design the program, to figure out how is this program going to start, how is it going to sustain itself, where am I going to get the workers, who am I going to reach, how am I going to connect with these people. All these things have to be laid out, and that's part of the task, knowing how to develop that overall plan. And then we would say, okay, we'll fund you. And here's the way we do it. For the first year, we've got your budget here, you've worked it out. We're going to fund you 100%. But over the next year, you're going to have to start going out to churches, to youth groups, et cetera, and start raising support. And we'll help you and try to teach you how to do that, as I'm doing here. And as you raise your support, we will continue to undergird your ministry. But at the end of the first year, we're going to cut you back 20%. So you have to be able to raise 20% of your system in the first year. The second year, we're going to cut you back another 20%. And the third year, another 20%. And the fourth, you got the picture here. So that over a five-year period, we basically drive you to self-sufficiency. So EAPE has this whole host of ministries. I think there are about 27 of them now, I thought at last count, that we have started, that we have nurtured, that have gotten off the ground. We help them for the first 5 years. And then we do one thing more. We continue to raise money, EAPE does, and keeps a certain amount in reserve. And the amount we keep in reserve is for a very important reason. Inevitably, in all of these ministries, there's going to be difficulty financially somewhere along the line. Now, every ministry runs into difficulty in its early development. And so we're always there and saying, oh, you need $100,000 because you've really run short in your program this year? Okay. We're going to give you $100,000, but there's one condition. And what's the condition? One of the members of our board goes onto your board for the next year because you didn't do something right. You failed at some point in fundraising and in promoting your program. And we're not just going to let you continue as though nothing happened. Something needs to be corrected, and we need to be involved in that to see to it that the correction takes place effectively. Do you follow this? So that we can really put the pressure on organizations. A good example. We have one program in Southwest Philadelphia called Cornerstone Christian Academy. It's a school that was started for boys and girls in the elementary school level who were falling between the cracks. It's a very interesting school. It's got 200 students. It's first-rate education. The testing of those students demonstrates that these kids are coming out better and better and better all the time. It's a wonderful program. The problem is that every single year, they were running into difficulty. They were running into shortfalls. And they would always come to us. And it would always be the same, that they didn't do their fundraising adequately. At a particular point, they came back and said, we're going to give you, we want a grant. We said, fine. You're going to get a grant. But here's the deal. We're only going to give you half the grant. And the other half of the money, along with additional funds, we are going to put into hiring somebody to work your school who knows how to raise money. One more thing. Your board doesn't get to choose the person. We get to choose the person. Because what happens with their board is that they don't have enough exposure around the country. And so what happens is that they end up picking up one of their friends. Oh, I know somebody who just lost his job with, never hire anybody who just lost his job. Lost his job with Fidelity Trust, and he's looking, he loves Jesus, and he wants to serve, I think he would be perfect, and that's who they get. What we ended up getting from, for the director of Cornerstone Christian Academy, who we now have as the label head of school, is a guy named Dick Olinger, who is the pastor of a very, very large church in Florida. But he was tired of ministering to old retired people. You know, you do years of this, and especially in Florida. During the winter months, the congregation gets huge. As soon as summer sets in, everybody goes home. They're all retired. Nobody wants to do anything, right? You can just hear, you know, Pastor, for 36 years, I served my church, First Presbyterian Church in Biloxi, Mississippi, and I've done my thing. I've made my contribution. It's time for younger people to take over the work of the church. And this poor guy's looking around and say, younger people? Where are the younger people? And so, you know, at a particular point, we hit him and said, look, you've been running this church for more than a decade. You've been raising lots of money for the church. You're perfect. He's a good-looking guy. He's middle-aged. When he walks into a church, all the middle-aged women swoon. All the middle-aged men say, hey, he looks like he's got what it takes. And he's been terrific at fundraising. The result is we brought him in. We funded him for the first year. After the first year, they've been doing great. As a matter of fact, we send them about $20,000 a year just as a token to say, hey, you're doing so great. We want you to have $20,000 more just to increase the effectiveness of your school in some way. There's something you want to do. There's something you need to do in order to facilitate this. But fundraising is a very important thing. So EAPE stands up here as a mother organization, creating new ministries and nurturing them, especially when they are in trouble. Bringing together the executive directors of these ministries. Here's another thing that we've learned. This is important for you who are going to go into urban work. Small organizations are fiscally more efficient than large organizations. If you've got a large organization that has an income of, let's say, I have a specific organization in mind. I'm not going to give you the name for obvious reasons, but it's a very, very big organization, and they have an income of $500 million a year. They spend about 30% of their income on overhead. Do you see? Because they set up these fancy offices and they have to have murals in a beautiful building. And you begin to say, what's going on here? If you go over to the EAPE offices, which is on the top floor of Fowler Hall, you got a couple of guys and a big mess of papers. And you're saying, you're telling me all of this mission, this whole missionary organization that has 300 full-time workers is operating out of here? Yeah. And you say, well, what does it cost for the overhead? Answer, nothing. First of all, the guy who is the executive director and raises all the money doesn't take a salary. Number one, I do it for free. I do it because it's part of my calling in Jesus. I earn money by speaking out on the circuit. So I don't need to do this or writing books. People, you can make a lot of money writing books about poverty. And if you can't see the irony of that, you have no sense of humor whatsoever. The reality is that I don't need the money. So I work for free. The school gives us a space without rent, the light, the heat. Up until recently, we had a phone company that gave us our phone use for free. So you can begin to see that the only real expense that we had was our monthly newsletter. The postage and sending that out and printing up the newsletter. Incidentally, I really was upset when we had to move to printing up our newsletter and getting a professional organization to send out the mailing. You say, why? Because in the early days of EAPE, and if you're starting off an organization, this is something that you need to do. You can Xerox your newsletter, but when you send it out, what you want to do is get your whole staff together for a couple of hours and hand address the envelopes. It will make all the difference in the world. I mean, stop to think about it. When you get the junk mail, you go through it, and if you see that, you can look at the envelope and you say, oh, I know where this came from. They had some organization, you know, if they're handwritten, do you see? Number one. Number two is not only would they be handwritten, but I would always ask the young people who were working with me to put a one line at the end. You know, dear Mr. Campolo, I can't tell you how grateful we are for your support. Signed, Mabel, a volunteer. Whoa, all of a sudden, it's not just another fundraising letter. It will increase the response dramatically, dramatically. It's very, very important that you understand that. So you can see I was a bit upset when we finally reached the point where our mailing list got so large we couldn't do that. So we had to move into it being professionally done, and it bothers me. I hate professionalism. I got to tell you this. The one thing about the church that drives me nuts is the way we all become so professional. Did you notice when I said raising money that I didn't say, as you came in today, you received a brochure of our organization. As you see this little tear-off slip, not at all. It looks too professional. Take a piece of paper. Let me I happen to have, incidentally, from this weekend, I was at a church in Florida. Was it Florida? No, I was in Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama. And I just happened to pick up a whole pile of names and addresses, and I want to show you what they look like when they come in here. I hope they're here. Maybe they're not here. They're just, people pick up any old broken up piece of paper they can find and throw it my way. It's just wonderful. I thought I had it right here available, but evidently oh yes, here they are. Put them in an envelope like this. There they are. You know, when I said any old slip of paper, that's any old slip of paper. People pick whatever is in the, and they put their names and addresses on. I want to tell you, once you get off the slick promotional professionalism, people say, that's what I like to see. I want my money spent on children. I don't want my money spent on expensive brochures. Have you ever heard that line? It works out much better. So I don't know, there's about 50 names and addresses there. You take 50, multiply it by 30, okay? What do you end up with? You end up with 1,500. Multiply that by 12. That's the year's support. Can you see what's going on here? With a minimum of effort, no fundraising banquets. We don't do fundraising banquets. No hullabaloo. It's easy. The thing is, I think the whole church has become too professional. My friend, Mark Hatfield, who was once the senator from Oregon, has this great line. He says, Christianity started in Israel. They took it to Greece and they made it into a philosophy. They took it to Rome and they made it into an organization. They took it to Europe, to the rest of Europe, and they made it into a culture. They brought it to America and they made it into a business enterprise. And my goodness, that describes the reality, doesn't it? The truth is, we have twisted Christianity. People want to give. They want to support. And this is the thing that you need to understand. Giving is a ministry. Giving is a ministry. What we act like is that we're doing these people, we're asking these people to do us a favor. I never approach it that way. I always approach it on the basis that I'm doing you a favor. You have resources. You can give them. This is a ministry. This is a Christian ministry. The Bible talks about the ministry of giving. And what I'm doing is giving you the opportunity to live out your ministry, to serve Jesus, to do the thing that God has equipped you to do. This is what I'm asking you to do. So never feel like they're doing you a favor. You're doing them a favor. In asking them to give, you are really calling them into ministry. And this is very important, that we see things this way and that we handle things this way. The next thing we do is any donation that comes into our organization over $500, $500 up, I write a personal note, which means I have to spend a lot of time writing personal notes. I just don't write thanks. I write a little card, and we write these things down. And the cards we have are very interesting cards because we have this situation where in Camden, New Jersey, we have a print shop, and the kids down there in this little print shop that's run by this group of guys that used to be in gang members, you know, they print up the cards, and on the back it says, printed it in an economic development program of the Evangelical Association for the Promotion of Education by young people in Camden, New Jersey. And I always, on one side of the card, you know, I write the little note. On the other side, please look at the back. Do you see? This impresses people. We're now using cards that are being made in Haiti. Beautiful little cards. And the same thing. Made in Haiti in one of our economic development programs. Send a nice personal note. Thank you. I don't know that you realize how important your gift is. Let me tell you what we're doing. I may be a line or two. And send it off. If it's between $100 and $500, young people in my office who are volunteers, they write notes to all of those people because, of course, we're dealing with huge numbers. Then the last thing, we got into conviction on this, and that is the concept of the widow's mite. What about the little old lady that's sending in $15 a month and she's on welfare? And she doesn't know whether or not she can even afford to do this. As Jesus said so well, maybe the person that is giving $1,000 is in fact giving much less than this poor old lady, this widow, who's really doing something incredibly sacrificial by sending in her $15 a month. So my office does this. Every time they give me one of these big givers, $500 or more, they give me the names and addresses of two people on our mailing list who are very faithful givers month after month, but are giving very small amounts of money. And I write thank you personal notes, just as though they were the $1,000 givers. I send notes to them. So for every rich cat that sends in a gift, there are two people who we call our widow's mite people. You say, this takes enormous amounts of time. Yes, it does. But I assure you, it's worth it. Because what you really are doing is you're affirming people and you're making people realize that their giving is important. I said it's a ministry. Do you affirm their ministry? Do you thank them for being ready to give on themselves to Jesus Christ and the kingdom? You've got to begin to look at the whole fundraising thing as a opportunity to enable people to live out a calling, to enable people to serve Jesus Christ effectively. And as they do, you have to treat them as servants of God, not simply as donors. Do you understand that? Now, there's one more thing we do that no other group does, and that's this. If you were to go to the mailing list and look up Tony Campolo, you will find that I have contributed nothing in the way of direct gifts to EAPA, except for this. Every 10th speaking engagement, the honorarium goes completely to EAPA. Do you see? But the reason why I don't give any money is for a very important reason. I have a little fund. And what happens is, inevitably, at least once a month, maybe more often, I get a letter from some person who's been supporting us at $20 a month for the last 20 years, literally 20 years, every month sending in their gift. And all of a sudden, you get a note. Dear Tony, my husband had a serious accident. He's in assisted living now. All we have is our Social Security check. I would love to support the ministry in the years to come. And it may not seem like it's much, but for us, the $20 is a great deal. We're not going to be able to support you any longer. I immediately write back with a very personal note, letting them know we're praying for them. And I get the whole gang in the office together and we pray for them. You know, I'm tired of these letters that say we're praying for you and they're not really praying for you. We pray for them. And the second thing is I take $1,000 out of my own pocket and put it in an envelope and say, dear Mrs. Jones, you have supported us so faithfully through the years. I wish I could do this every month, but I can't. But here's a gift to help you through these difficult days. You've been part of our family. We've always said you're part of our family of supporters. Family members help each other. You helped us. It's our turn to help you. I just thought it was the right thing to do. Well, you know what's happening. Nancy will tell you what's happening. When these dear old people die, guess who's in their will? I didn't think that was going to happen. No, I didn't. I did not know it was going to happen. All of a sudden, these checks start coming in. There was a dear elderly woman, Mrs. Jones, over here in just outside of Norristown, Pennsylvania, who had a mentally retarded brother and a mentally retarded sister. Her whole life, this woman did housekeeping and took care of her brother and her sister, never married because nobody would marry her and take these two kids with her. Both of the children died, and eventually she died. When she died, I don't know where she got it. She had been saving money and saving money and saving money, and we got a check for $100,000. And you say, where did this woman get the money? I don't know. She just lived a frugal life, took care of her brother and her sister all those years, and we wrote personal notes to her, and we connected with her. Incidentally, if you go up to my office, you'll find that we have a lot of work to do, but there are dry spells in our work week. And the truth is that whenever the young people who are working in my office have an hour or two and nothing specific to do, James, who is my personal assistant, immediately gives them a series of names and phone numbers and says, call these people on the telephone and tell them thank you. You need to recognize that these people are ministering to you if you're the head of this organization, but you have an obligation to minister to them. And to just treat these people as though their names on the roll that send in money is wrong. These are people who are making sacrifices for the kingdom of God, and you need to nurture them with phone calls and notes, and you've got to be in touch with them constantly to let them know how important they are. And this is not a source of manipulation to get more money out of them. It's a way of ministering to people who are ministering to you and to your ministry. Raising money is very important. But what we've done over the years is every time we start a new ministry, we spin it off and make it independent. So Urban Promise, which is working in Toronto, Canada, Vancouver, Camden, New Jersey, and Wilmington, Delaware, has its own board of directors. What's more is they've learned from us that the smaller the organization, the more efficient The result is that Urban Promise, instead of having one organization, has spun off Vancouver, Toronto, Wilmington. Each of these has its own executive director and its own board of directors. The result is the amount of overhead goes down to almost nothing. Because when you don't have a big organization, I'll tell you where you, what you do. You operate out of the basement of some church. You operate out of somebody's basement. You don't waste money on overhead. Small organizations do that. I worry about these organizations that after 15 or 20 years have this big building, you know. This is our corporate headquarters. This is the small organization. So everything we develop and spin off. And we're there. We stay in contact. We get together with the leaders. We try to counsel. We try to troubleshoot for them. But each ministry is, in fact, separate, a separate entity. Of course, the other genius of that is that the failure of any one ministry doesn't affect the rest of the work. And some ministries will go south. Some ministries will fail. We have had ministries fail. We had a program called Nehemiah Ministries in Philadelphia that was a really good program, but it just didn't succeed. No problem. When it went down the tubes, none of the other ministries felt the effects of this. Whereas if you're in one gigantic organization, if anything goes wrong in one place, it affects everything else. Another thing is the insurance policies. I mean, if some group like Camden is having an accident with a van every month, the insurance bill goes up and up and up, but it doesn't affect the other organizations. Do you follow that? And if anybody's going to get sued, and we live in a day of legal suits, you're only one organization is going to get sued, not the whole organization. And, you know, people look at organizations and say, gee, what's their income? It's $1,500,000 a month. We're going to sue them for X number of bucks. But if, in fact, the organization has a very, you can see the genius. They're going to, legal suits are always filed on the basis of what they are convinced that the organization can provide. Can an organization be sued out of existence? Yes, it can. But note, you're only suing out of existence what? One entity, not the whole organization. Do you follow that? And no great sweat. When we've had one organization sued out of existence quite unjustly, but it was okay. They declared bankruptcy. The thing closed down. Nobody else was affected. The poor guy that was running the thing, we said, don't sweat it. You know what we're going to do? We're going to create a new 501c3 organization. You're going to go back into the same city. You're going to do exactly the same things, but we're going to start from scratch, and we're going to treat you as though you're a brand new organization. You see, small organizations are really the way to go. So we use McDonald's as our model. Every McDonald's is run as a separate entity, as a separate franchise, do you see? And that's the genius of the thing. So what goes wrong in one McDonald's doesn't affect the whole chain. It's not a bad thing to study these organizational systems, because the children of darkness are wiser than the children of light. And as my pastor mentor used to say, and they work harder too. And they do work harder. So we have all these organizations. Let me just run down what we're doing. The first ministry we ever started was the Evangelical University of the Dominican Republic. It's a university located primarily in Santiago in the Dominican Republic. I'm not even sure that they remember me. They don't remember me. I'm sure they don't. But it was like our first thing 30 years ago. And within about 5 years, the program in the Dominican Republic, in the city of Santiago, this university, this urban university, became self-supporting. The way they started raising money was quite incredible. I mean, it's not the thing you could do here in the United States. One day a month, the entire student body would get little cans and go from door to door in the city. The city was so proud of their university that people would put in 50 cents, a dollar, $2. But huge amounts of money came in that way as the entire student body took a day off to go door to door on behalf of the university. Then the government started supporting them. Today, that school is totally supported by indigenous funding from the government and from individual donors. So that's why they don't know me anymore, because you only remember people when they keep giving you money, and we haven't given them money for years, do you see? I do have an honorary, I do have a doctorate from the school. They wanted to give me a doctorate, but they didn't have the concept of the of honorary doctorates in the Dominican Republic. But they did have a doctorate in education. So I have, in addition to my PhD, a doctorate of education, even though I never took a course. They decided that the faculty voted to give me an honorary doctorate. So I got a doctorate from the Evangelical University of the Dominican Republic. Another school we started there was started in the city of Azua. And it's called the Technical University of the South. The difference between the two universities is this. The Evangelical University is totally Christian. The students that come in are expected to be Christian. The faculty is totally Christian. They are expected to sign on to the Apostles' Creed, which I think is a great statement of faith. Got the picture? Totally Christian. It's a Christian school like Eastern, like Houghton College, like Wheaton College. It's that kind of school. We found that there were a lot of young people in the Dominican Republic who so wanted to go to the university that they would pretend to be Christians. You can see, hey, if this is what you got to do to get into the school, man, I believe in Jesus. What else? You got to be born again. Oh, yeah, I was born again. You know, I mean, you can just imagine what you're going to get. So we started a second university wherein you don't have to be a Christian. As a matter of fact, it's a secular school from get-go. We started as a secular school, and it continues as a secular school because I believe that the Church of Jesus Christ should not only minister to its own people, but to people who aren't Christians. Here's what it says in the Bible. Here's what it says in the sixth chapter of Galatians. Do good unto all men and women, and especially unto those who are the household of faith. No, it's not just the household of faith that you do good for. I mean, you show certain preferences for them, but your obligation is to do good for what? Everyone. Everyone, do you see? So often in urban ministry, there are times when people will say to you, are you winning converts? I would like to say yes all the time, but there are some things that we end up doing where we don't win converts. We have close association with a young man that I've nurtured and been friends with ever since he was a teenager, who runs a ministry that stretches all over the United Kingdom. The ministry is called Oasis, and the young man's name is Steve Chalk, who I think is the most brilliant Christian organizers around. He is magnificent. But there was a time when, you know, you get this rich cat in London and you say, I think he can really help Steve, because Steve is among 25 different ministries. He has this one ministry where he has these houses for runaway kids, because London is the kind of city which attracts the runaways. Big cities do that. That you always find that they attract the runaways. And so what Steve does is builds these houses, gets these houses, and puts people in there to take these kids off the streets at night so that they don't have to, in fact, sell their bodies in order to have a place to sleep and a meal to eat. And so there he is at dinner. It's a great scene. I want you to get the scene. And this dear Christian man wants to give him some money. And he says, but before I give you money, I want to know, how many of the young people that come into your house get saved? Steve, the genius that he is, said, how many of them do you want to be saved? 10%, 20%? What do you think would be acceptable? What would you like to see happen? The guy said, well, what I'd like to see happen is 100%. He said, done. He said, how can you say that? It's easy. It's a cold, rainy night. The kid hasn't had a meal all day, has no place to sleep. He's at the door. And you say to him, you want to stay here tonight? You want to eat? You want to have a bed? You got to accept Jesus as your personal Savior. I guarantee you, everyone will say yes. Is that what you want? Guy said, no, that's not what I want. Fine. We will continue to testify to Jesus Christ, but we're not going to play manipulative games with people and make accepting Jesus as some kind of requisite for getting the blessings of the movement. Do you follow that? Very important. So you do good unto everyone, but especially unto those who are the household of faith. Among the ministries we have started are Urban Promise. I cited that. The other one, another one that started was Mission Year. And that's on its own. It's been on its own for a long time, raises its own funds. This year, I think they have about 70 young people working in Philadelphia, Atlanta, Georgia, and Chicago. We were working in Oakland. We hope to go back into Oakland again. You have that shirt on.
We also have New Orleans.
New Orleans, that's right. I forgot New Orleans. We got a team down there that's constantly involved in working in that situation. Got the picture? It's an independent organization with about 70 full-time workers, young people like Stephanie, who have given a year of their lives. We call it Mission Year. Now, these dear people like Stephanie have to do what? They have to raise their own financial support. They've got to write to their uncles, their aunts, their home church. We tell them how to do it. Write to your home church and say, Pastor, what really works is when I write, Pastor, Stephanie is a member of your church and she's working in New Orleans this year, full time, working with the poorest of the poor, ministering to people in desperate need. She needs financial support. Now, I realize that you have a lot of concerns there in your own church, because I understand you just had the recreation room refurbished and new carpet put on the church floor, and I hear that you've improved your organ. But if there's any money left over to do the work of missions, Stephanie needs your help. You know what happens? Most churches want to give to their own people. Most churches, I mean, if you got a choice and you're a member of a local church and your money can either go to the denominational cooperative program or Stephanie, who grew up in the church. I remember teaching dear Stephanie when she was in our Sunday school program. Oh, she's a sweet, wonderful Christian. And she needs support. Of course I'll support her. Given the choice between an informal bureaucracy and Stephanie, who grew up in the church, it's a no-brainer where the money's going to go. But each member of Mission Year raises his or her support. And one of the reasons why the program does so well is that a certain amount of money that Stephanie raised as a Mission Year volunteer goes to the maintenance of the organization. See, about 5 to 10% goes to the Mission Year offices to maintain the executive staff and the whole program that operates around the country, do you see? Because every city has an executive director that ministers to the young people who live in the city. So it works that way. Mission Year is another program. Another program is called Beyond Borders. This works primarily with Haiti and Haitian people. Interestingly enough, one of our biggest things is working among Haitian people in the Dominican Republic. The economy of the Dominican Republic has improved so much over the last 25 years that they can't get Dominicans to cut sugar anymore, because it's such a hard and menial task. So they bring in Haitians by the thousands. And these poor people are living in this country where they don't know how to speak the language. They live together in poverty conditions in the eastern half of the country particularly. And so we have a whole mission organization that's working with them. And we're working in Haiti in itself. There are two things that happen in Haiti. We have what we call literacy centers for children. There are, get this, about 300,000 slave children in Haiti. You usually don't think of Haiti as having slaves. They have slaves. They don't call them slaves, they call them restaveks. These are children that come from families that are so poor that their families give them away. Those who take them in reduce them to servitude. It's horrible. They are not treated like children. They are, in almost every case, they are treated as less. We have to run our classes for our literacy centers from about 4:30 in the afternoon until about 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night, because the kids have got to do their work all day long. But they know that if they can learn how to read and write in a country where there's 80% illiteracy, they've got a chance to get out of this. At our peak, we're no longer at our peak in that area, and I'll tell you why. At our peak, we were running about close to 100 of these literacy centers, each with about 40 or 50 kids in them. So that's a lot. Incidentally, every one of these literacy centers was had a teacher that was a Haitian. The thing that we do is provide them with about $200 a month. The net result is that we could establish a school for $2,400 a year. So if I go to a rich church like St. Luke's, which is a rich church in Birmingham, Alabama, I could always say, hey, you're wondering what to buy your wife for Christmas? Buy her a school. We'll send you a photograph of the school with the kids out in front, and you're going to say, we'll even name the school after your wife. Here. And you can give her that for Christmas. She's already got everything. You're trying to figure out what to come up with. $24 a month. I do a lot of corporate things. I love corporate things. Because if I can get a group of corporate executives in a room, I say, now which one of you guys cannot afford $2,400 a month? Come on now. You're all executives. And there's not anybody in this room that's not making less than six figures. $24. And you're going to make a difference in the lives of 40 kids. You're going to rescue them from despair. How do you say no to that? That becomes very personal, you see. Once again, I've got the picture. I know the kids. The place is connected to me in a personal way. This transcends. So we've got this child literacy program. The reason why that's declining is because the young people who are working in Haiti, this you'll like, Anna, you'll like this, decided we can go on ministering to Restivex, or we can spend a lot of our time and energy in destroying the Restivex system. Let's get rid of child slavery. That, no, now that's, I can just see your eyes, you know, lightening up and the wheels. Exactly. We've been taking the casualties of the system. Isn't it time to change the system? Do you see? So a great deal of their energy and time and efforts are going into eliminating the Restivex system. But let me just say, for those who are interested in economic development, you can't get rid of the system without creating jobs for these kids. What are they going to do? Where are they going to get the money? If they're going to go back and live with their mother, what's the mother going to do to support this kid? She gave up the kid with great tears, but hey, I gave up my child because I couldn't feed him. Are you going to change the system so she can feed that child? Fair question, isn't it? So you see how I hate to say economics is so crucial, but economic development is crucial in doing away with the Restivex system. But we've made contact with political leaders. We now have on board Marion Wright Edelman, the head of the Children's Defense League. She's very concerned about what's happening to children in Haiti. You got to make contact with these people. Join us. Let's get rid of the Restivex system. Let's get together the money to support these kids without them having to be slaves. See, that's part of it. So that program is declining. In its place, we have initiated a program for adult literacy. This has taken off like nobody believed it would. A young man by the name of Kent Annan, a graduate of Princeton, sophisticated guy, working down in Haiti. He came up with this very simple idea. He would teach Haitian adults how to read. They Xerox passages of scripture in Creole. They get 10 to 12 people and put them in a circle, and they give them these pages. And they teach them then how to sound out the words phonetically. It's very easy. Interestingly enough, French was the official language of the country up until about 5 years ago. The problem was that 95% of the people didn't know French. They spoke Creole. You say, well, why was French the official language? Now you begin to see how oppressive political systems operate. If only the members of our party know how to speak the language. When we write the laws, the only people that will understand them are the members of our little group. Keeping knowledge in the hands of an elite is power. Knowledge is power. And these elitists who were running the country, who were controlling the political and economic system of the country, didn't want the ordinary people to learn how to speak and learn how to read and write Creole. A change came 5 years ago, and Creole now is the official language of the country. But there are very few books that have been translated into Creole. The Bible is one of them. And they sound out these words. So you get these people in a circle, and we're going to go through the Sermon on the Mount. Here are the first five verses. Celine, you're going to have these. Next five you, all the way around the group. Each person takes turns sounding out the words. We can teach somebody how to read phonetically in about a month. They go around, everybody reads their verses. Then we stop. And we say, the next half hour, we're going to remain in absolute silence. Because in the next half hour, we're going to let the Holy Spirit teach you. Doesn't the Bible say, doesn't Jesus say, if I leave you, I will send the Holy Spirit, and he will lead you into all truth. He will teach you all things. Doesn't it say that? Read the 14th, 15th, 16th chapter of John. That's what it says. So they sit there, and their eyes are closed, and they meditate on the verses that they just read. At the end of the half hour, we say, okay, we're going to go around the circle again. But now, you are going to explain to the rest of the group what God taught you, what the Holy Spirit taught you in your time of silence as you reflected upon these scriptures. What did you learn from this? What does this scripture say to you? In what way did it speak to your situation in life? And they go around the circle a second time so that you not only have read the words, but you now have to comprehend them. And you have to be able to share what you have just learned. So you can see it's a brilliant way to learn how to read. But because I'm an evangelical, you can see what the other side of the story is. You've got the whole group evangelizing each other, teaching each other from the scriptures. And I believe that the scriptures, under the power of the Holy Spirit, have incredible converting power. And that's what goes on. So I asked Ken, I said, how many people are in this program now? Because it's only been in place for a couple of years. He said, well, it's hard to say. I say, I'm writing a newsletter every month. I got to, in fact, know some numbers. Give me a high figure and a low figure. Well, he said, in any given month, maybe there's 15,000 in the program. On a really good month, maybe 25,000. You know what this program is costing us? Talk about a small organization. It costs us the paper and Kent's salary and insurance. That's it, health insurance. That's it. That takes care of it. Because we have no buildings. You know, if you turned this over to a big organization, they would be building school buildings. And every time people go down to Haiti, they say, we'd like to see your ministry. There's nothing to see. The literacy centers for children, we hold them in churches. We don't build our own buildings. The adult literacy centers usually are a circle of people meeting under a tree. There's nothing to see. If you want to see the thing in action, we can show you that. But we can't show you a building. We can't show you a facility. I am tired of Christian organizations spending millions and millions and millions of dollars on buildings to honor somebody who said, I dwell not in temples made with hands. That's not my line. That's Kierkegaard's. So we have this work in Haiti. We have a program in the northeast of England called Aquila House for battered women in the city of Newcastle. And Newcastle is the nightclub capital of the world. On Friday and Saturday night, young people from all over England come there. There's about 50 nightclubs. They're door to door. They're closed during the week. On the weekend, they all open, and thousands of young men and women come. If you've ever seen a meat market, you have to come to Newcastle on a Friday night or a Saturday night. When I say a meat market, the temperature can be freezing, below freezing, like 20 degrees Fahrenheit. You'll see almost every girl without any overcoat, wearing these sexy outfits, generally exposing from their shoulders down to show off their sexual wares. It's the meat market of all meat markets. It's horrible. It's horrible. So what we do is two things. One is every once in a while, these girls get left on the street. Their parents don't want to see them anymore because they're screwing around like this. Who's going to pick up these women? Very often, they're battered and beaten. So we have these Aquila houses. And I think there's about 150 women in them now, young women. Generally, when they get in trouble, it's when they get pregnant. Then the guys that have been having sex with them don't want anything to do with them anymore. They can't go home. They end up on the street, and they're going to become prostitutes unless somebody steps in. And we're the ones that step in and pick them up. You say, how do you make contact with them? That's interesting. Youth for Christ, British Youth for Christ, works very closely with us. In most of the nightclubs, there are Youth for Christ workers there every night, sitting at one of the tables. If you see the staff, you'd think they look like death warmed up because they got the purple hair and the rings. And you know, somebody said, wrote to me and said, I saw one of your workers and he had all kinds of rings and his body was pierced. And I wrote back and said, Jesus has a certain affinity for people with pierced bodies. You got to have a sense of humor in this business. So what happened is this, that they meet in the nightclub. They just sit there, and you see these people, and they come over and sit down at the table, and you start talking to them, and you find out what their problems are, and you say, hey, I can help you. It's being, you know, the old Youth for Christ system was, we'll set up a rally in downtown Newcastle and say, whosoever will may come, and all the church groups will come. You're not going to meet the lost, the forsaken, the battered, beaten people of the world by asking them to come to a rally. Jesus never said they would come. He said, we have to go. And so that's our urban program there, the Aquila House. There have been spin-off organizations all over the place. In Pittsburgh, there's a young man that came out of this program, Celine Gabriel, who started this thing called the Pittsburgh Project. If you want to do a good study, you might do a study on the Pittsburgh Project. You were shaking your head. Do you know about it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How do you know about it?
Well, I work for the CCO, Coalition for Christian Outreach.
Okay, very good. Well, here's the thing. Celine started out of a church. When he graduated, he went to a church, and he began to get his young people together to fix up broken down houses in Pittsburgh, particularly elderly people whose houses should be condemned and torn down, but there's no place to move these people. So these people live in these broken down, beat up houses. Jeez. So he gets a group of young people with some professional counseling and help. They go in, put a new wiring system in, new plumbing, paint the place up, fix the place up. They probably have fixed up somewhere around 1,500 houses in Pittsburgh right now, to this present time. The city has been so grateful that they turned over a school that wasn't operative anymore, which they've made into a wonderful dormitory, so that 100 young people can come in at any given time and they can house them. You see, youth groups come in from outside and they can house them in this place. And they have a professional plumber and a professional electrician on staff to guide them in what needs to be done. The Catholic church that was two doors down from this school was down to a mere handful. The Diocese of Pittsburgh said, hey, we're going to close the church. You can have it. And they've made it into this wonderful place that can serve as a gym, an auditorium, all kinds of stuff. But Celine doesn't get any money from us. In the beginning, I used to go out to Pittsburgh and do fundraising banquets for him or rallies for him. But he's on his own now, and the thing is so successful. And people all over Pittsburgh are contributing to make this work. Incidentally, the work in Haiti requires less and less money every year. You know why? Because the thing is so relevant to the needs of the people that the Rotary Clubs of Haiti are putting up most of the money for the literacy programs for adults. When you do something that really makes sense, the business people in the area are ready to put the money in. One of the worst things that can happen is to set a mission program down there and all the money comes from the outside and the people of the country feel they have no ownership. If you were to go down there and say, what is Beyond Borders program with literacy? And they say, I don't know that there is one. What about the Rotary Clubs? Oh, yes. The Rotary Club has this wonderful program. Yeah. It's not the Rotary Club puts up some money, but this is the way the thing works. There needs to be more creative thinking. Because if you're going to do urban ministry, you've got to know how to raise money. You need to know how to get indigenous people to support it. Incidentally, one of the best things that you can do, and this is something you must know about and is described in my book in detail, is you need to know how to run town meetings. My church, which is Mount Carmel Baptist Church in West Philadelphia, is expert in running town meetings. Now, here's how the town meeting works. It takes about 6 months to set up the meeting. Christian people are used to doing is putting something in the church bulletin and printing up some posters and putting them around. It won't work. For 6 months leading up to the town meeting, you have to visit everybody in the community that has any influence whatsoever. That means anybody that's running a little store, you have to say, we're having a meeting at the church to discuss what we can do to improve our neighborhood. Promise me you'll be there. Go down to the police who are walking the streets. Go down. We need the police who are in this area to come and participate in the discussion. Insofar as it is possible, we try to get the drug pushers on the corner. You say, why they? Because they are influential people in the neighborhood. You want anybody who has any influence to show up. You go down to the school. You try to get the teachers to come. You certainly get the principal to come. You contact everybody who's doing anything that is exercising influence in that community to come together on a given night. Got the picture? And note, you're not going to be pious about this. You're going to get everybody there who's influencing this community. And the thing is going to be divided into two sections if you're going to do this urban-wise. Here it is. If the meeting starts at 7, from 7 to 8:30, you have a discussion on what the problems are in this neighborhood. And you have a magic marker and some paper to write it down as it comes off, or a blackboard or something, as some way of writing down these things so everybody can see them, you see. The streets are not safe. The schools are not functioning well. The kids are cutting school too much. There are too many drugs on the street corner, yada, 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 yada. You can put down all the problems that exist in the neighborhood. List them all. And talk about them, and listen to what people say about these problems. You take a break, have some refreshments, then you come back, and the next hour and a half is, what can we do to solve some of these problems? Let's pick five of them. We can't solve them all tonight. Let's pick five of them that we think are urgent. What can we do to solve these problems? Now, here's the rule. Listen to this rule carefully. This is most important. Any solution that is being proposed has to depend solely on resources that exist in the neighborhood. If somebody says, I can get a grant from City Hall, no good. What City Hall giveth one year, it taketh away the next. I assure you, you create total instability. You've got to say, everything that goes on that we're going to promote is going to be sustained by people and by financial resources that exist within this community. If we need some money to go in the program, we say to the storekeepers, how many of you are willing to contribute something towards this? How many of you are willing to put some money in? This is your neighborhood. And you'll come up with them establishing a community watch, you know, to parade the streets to see that it's safe. You'll end up with tutors going into the school, working in the school system. They'll come up with ideas of how to address these problems, which do not require that you step outside the neighborhood. Very important that you deal with the community as a community, because what you have to do more than anything else, if give people the sense that the problems that are pervading their lives are problems that they can resolve themselves. Remember, the name of the game is to empower indigenous people. Empower indigenous people. This is crucial.